A tale of love, peace, and friendship.
Dear Grandpa Tree, I wish that we could stay friends forever. Me, Dashen, and Haiyan.
Friends forever!
Friends forever!
Based on real events, Echoes of Ku Liang, a radio drama series, relates the warm and vibrant life stories of the Ku Liang friends, set in the historical tapestry of the 20th century.
Match! Match!
We'll gather the balls for you!
Let's see if we can catch some big fish and ask my mom to make some fish bowl soup tonight.
Do you guys know what I can do?
Bing, bing, an, an.
Bing, bing. Bing, an. Bing, an. Symbolizing being safe.
床前明月光，疑是地上霜。
Moonlight,
举头望明月。
At the foot of my bed,
思故乡。
Seeming like frost on the ground.
With spellbinding performances and immersive sound effects, Echoes of Ku Liang, crafted by CGTN Radio, will premiere this April on radio and all major podcast platforms.
Such a beautiful story.
Follow Echoes of Ku Liang as it unfolds across generations, bridging continents and cultures in a celebration of love, friendship, and the enduring spirit of home.
Hometown. How far we apart, Ku Liang, where we call it home.
Discussion keeps the world turning.
This is Roundtable.
You're listening to Roundtable with myself, He Young. I'm joined by Xinyu in the studio and Josh Cotterell on the line. Coming up, if someone practices vegetarianism, they never eat meat or fish. More Chinese people have embraced some form of this idea. We explore the growing interest in vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free lifestyle choices among the general public. And we share with you what's brought us sheer delight this week. Join us for a dose of positivity, laughter, and all things that make our hearts sing in Roundtable's Happy Place. Your voice matters, and we want to hear it in our heart-to-heart segment. Got a question, something you are itching to share? Fire up the voice memo and hit us up at ezfmroundtable@foxmail.com. Our podcast listeners can find us at Roundtable China on Apple Podcast. Now, as we continue our discussion, the food industry landscape looks vastly different now compared to the past. Sugar-packed sweets and drinks are losing public interest, while food manufacturers find themselves under increasing pressure to make their products healthier. The health food movement has gained significant momentum in recent years, driven by a growing cultural and social awareness around food safety and environmental sustainability. Amidst this broader shift, vegetarianism has transformed from the fringes of society to become a widely accepted dietary choice, lifestyle, and thriving business opportunity. And there are lots of terms related to vegetarianism. Josh, please, you know, take up explainer duty today and give us the definitions.
Sure. Well, there's a few variations of vegetarianism. And the first one, of course, is veganism. And this is where one avoids all animal products. That includes dairy, eggs, and even honey. Focuses on plant-based foods like nuts and vegetables and fruits. There's also lacto-vegetarianism. And this is where one consumes dairy products but will avoid meat, eggs, and other animal products. So they will. It includes milk and yogurt and butter and things like that. There's also an ovo-vegetarian. This includes eggs in the diet, but avoids meat and dairy. So things like fruits, vegetables, and grains and eggs are included in this one, basically. So it's just including eggs. There's also lacto-ovo-vegetarianism. And this includes dairy products and eggs, but still avoids meat and animal-derived ingredients. It includes milk, cheese, yogurt, eggs, and stuff like this. There's also like semi-vegetarianism, or sometimes it's called flexitarianism. And this is where somebody primarily follows a vegetarian diet, but occasionally consumes meat or fish. I'm sure quite a lot of vegetarians would argue that this is just not being a vegetarian, right? But I think the idea of this is that I think it's often motivated by environmental concerns, health concerns, or like ethical reasons. And there's also another one, which is pescatarianism. And this is where you would eat seafood and fish in the diet, but you won't eat meat, red meat, or poultry, which would be chicken. And so there's quite a lot of different ones. But again, I would say that probably quite a few vegans or vegetarians would say that it's either all or nothing, you know? But there are a lot of varieties in different terms here.
All right. And also total vegetarians, i.e. vegans, apparently some of them don't use animal products,
yeah, right,
such as silk or leather. Yeah. And no wonder I bought this pair of shoes the other day, which I had to pay extra, and it's called vegan leather shoes. So there you go.
Yeah. Vegetarianism actually has an ancient origin. It can be traced back to as early as 700 BC. So I think that's because early human food culture were largely based on plants. And China's vegetarian culture is often traced back to Buddhism. So I think vegetarianism has a lot to do with health, ethics, religion, and also environmentalism.
Yes, indeed. And there's another popular lifestyle choice or dietary choice called gluten-free. You see this a lot in American TV shows or whatnot. A gluten-free diet excludes any foods that contain gluten, which is a protein found in wheat and several other grains. And it means eating only whole foods that don't contain gluten, such as fruits, vegetables, meat, and eggs, as well as processed gluten-free foods like gluten-free bread or pasta. So I did not expect so many terms, and I am still a little confused, but it feels like I need to sort of look at the glossary that you guys just provided for me just to really get what everybody's choice it is when it comes to all these different kinds of foods. So how does vegetarianism impact one's health, both positively and potentially negatively? Let's debunk the myths around vegetarianism.
Vegetarian diets are thought to have quite a lot of benefits. First of all, it comes with a lower saturated fat and cholesterol, and it offers more vitamins, dietary fiber, and also other nutrients. So it can reduce the risk for many chronic diseases, such as heart disease and also type 2 diabetes. But there's still not so enough data to say exactly how a vegetarian diet influences your long-term health, because there are so many factors like smoking, drinking, and physical exercise that are into play. But there are also some people, they have concerns about vegetarian diets, whether it can provide a balanced nutritional level such as protein and vitamin B12.
And also for a lot of people who are concerned about their health, especially when China, coming from an agrarian society and also a developing economy for many years, and then you go through that phase of people expecting to eat more pork, or, well, that's the main source of meat that Chinese people enjoy, or also beef or whatnot. It's been seen as having more protein in your diet is not only testament to better health, but also better socioeconomic conditions or whatnot. But maybe one can argue that for a lot of Chinese folks, we've reached a stage that, you know, if you're concerned about your heart health and trying to avoid diabetes or whatnot, and then maybe cutting out red meat altogether, or at least reduce the consumption of red meat, could be really good for health. And is that more like a educated guess, or are there facts to substantiate this claim? Josh, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that there probably is some socioeconomic link, but I think there's a multitude of factors and examples that could maybe not contradict that point, but just show that it's not always the case. I think that, I mean, when it comes to cultural and social norms, these vary from country to country. And then when you take into factors like religion, where dietary rules about what can and cannot be consumed really vary all over the world, regardless of the socioeconomic conditions. You see that there can be a lot of exceptions to this rule. But I think that you do have a point there. I think that in some societies, meat can be considered a symbol of prosperity and social status. And as you also said, He Yang, it can also be seen as nutritious and healthy. When food insecurity occurs, I think that meat consumption can provide essential nutrients, right? Such as protein, vitamin B12, and things like this. So if that particular animal, for example, is in abundance in that part of the world, then it's probably going to be consumed. But there are a lot of exceptions to this rule. I know that countries such as India, right? Vegetarian has a deep cultural and religious root in India. with a massive part of the population adhering to vegetarian diets due to Hinduism and also Buddhist beliefs as well, that, you know, compassion towards animals, etc. And there's also just culturally an abundance of vegetarian friendly ingredients in Indian cuisine as well. And this might be a reason why my own country has a lot of vegetarians in the United Kingdom, and it's increasing a lot. And Indian food, coincidentally, is extremely popular in the United Kingdom. But also, there's a massive rise in vegetarianism in my own country. So the reason for that would probably be because the UK is quite an affluent country, has been for some time. And so the choice of plant-based products is really vast in the UK. You can be a vegetarian and eat meals every day that basically taste like meat if you want to, because of the vast variety of them. So where these examples lie with this statement that you made about the link between socioeconomic status and dietary customs, it's quite complex, I think. And there's a lot of factors that come into it.
I think in China, we have this food culture that, especially in some of these important occasions, we tend to have big meals. And one of the main dish or the biggest dish on the table is meat, such as pork, beef, or chicken. So I think that's why I feel like I have like a long distance from being a vegetarian, because I am not raised to consume only plants or vegetables or fruits. To not consume meat is something that I cannot believe I will do. So that's another, I think, culturally thing. But also in some parts of the country, we have this Hui ethnic minority. They do not consume pork. So probably religion and beliefs, they play an important role in people's dietary choices. Mm-hmm.
And also, if you look at food industry reports in recent years, there's definitely been a rise of light meals. And these usually consist of salads. I call them rabbit food. And for some people, like, it might be a little bit difficult to go full vegan. And therefore, you know, throw in a chunk of salmon or beef fillet or whatnot. But people are still more aware, I think, at least for some of these folks who follow food trends and are concerned about their health, to eat, you know, a more balanced meal with veggies and maybe a reduced portion of meat and not fully consume meat. And I think that might be a little bit difficult to pinpoint exactly. Does it come from environmental sustainability concerns or just personal health concerns, or maybe it's merely a food fad? But definitely people are making these consumption choices on their meals because you gotta do it every day, right? And it's interesting to see what people's consumption patterns are in that sense. So is there de facto a rise in veggie appetites? The last time I checked, when I looked up on Google vegetarianism, and all the reports from the UK, for example, came in asking about vegan and instead of just vegetarianism. So I suppose folks in the UK might have gone a step further in going total vegetarianism. At least this is what they are looking up on the internet. And what about elsewhere around the world? Is there definitely this commitment of more people to vegetarianism?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely the global market for vegan and plant-based products is expanding. The global vegan food market has reached a value of $24.6 billion, and it is projected to grow further in 2024. And also the global plant-based meat market is estimated to generate $10 billion US dollars in revenue.
Josh, what's your observation towards, you know, the reasons why more people might be committed to turning vegan or vegetarianism or whatnot?
I think, again, it varies from country to country, but I think that something that's quite universal and is definitely a major factor in my own country is that there is a growing concern for the environment. I think that there's increased awareness of the environmental impact of things like animal agriculture. It's visible on labels in the supermarket and things like this. A lot of brands are trying to get the appropriate sticker that shows that they're environmentally friendly and sustainable and things like this. I think that younger generations are particularly concerned about this. And I think that there's a growing health consciousness. I think there's a growing awareness of how excessive consumption of red meat especially can lead to risks of various things. So I think these are two important factors. I also think that there's quite a lot of innovation. I think there's some quite exciting things going on with veganism right now, and sort of that challenge to create a dish that is, you know, nutritionally complete, also tasty and not boring, yet has no meat is quite exciting and can often lead to really interesting foods. I know that when I go to London to visit some of my friends that live there in the UK, we'll often go to vegan restaurants, even though they're not vegan, simply because they're some of the best restaurants in London. They're some of the most exciting ones, because you're just eating something that you never thought could be created. And some of it, you wouldn't believe that there's no meat in it, honestly. I think that also another major factor is celebrity endorsements as well. The amount of celebrities and actors and musicians that are vegan now is just massive, right? And they have such a huge influence when it comes to social media as well. The growth of social media, of course, like with many things, influences trends. So I think these are some of the biggest factors.
Right. Just a quick follow-up question here, Josh. You know, there's another stereotype which impedes them from being converted to vegetarianism. That is, if you're engaged with a plant-based diet, then people think of weak health, pasty face, and, you know, difficult to sustain your physical health. But you mentioned, you know, there are lots of people who have, let's say, converted to veganism. So what are your thoughts? Did what I just say stay as sort of like a misconception, or is there maybe a degree of truth to it?
I think that there's no smoke without fire. And I think there is maybe a little bit of truth to the fact that if you do decide to go vegan, you certainly have to make some effort to get all of the nutrients that you need, to get all the protein you need, right? And I think that, but it's becoming easier. So I guess that, you know, a lack of protein really is what people allude to, I think, when they go for this stereotype. But actually, it's easy enough to get it, I think. It's just that you need to be familiar with the food that you're eating. You need to be conscious of what you're putting in your body. So I know that this is definitely not true. I mean, I didn't eat meat till I was about 9 years old. I grew up vegetarian, my whole family, and we were fine. We were very, very healthy and active and all grew very tall. So I think we were okay, you know. But my mum and dad, I know they've told me that they did have to learn about nutrition. They had to make sure that they were giving us, you know, enough protein, et cetera, and a varied diet. So it does require one to learn a bit, but I think that that's probably something we should all do anyway, right?
Good point. Yes, and there's many things going on in the minds of consumers every day when it comes to what do you put on the table for today's lunch and dinner and breakfast as well. Going vegetarian or not, a lot of people are consuming all this information out there. And one reason why people go vegetarian is basically, apparently it does a lot of good for the environment. And we all know that agriculture and animal husbandry is among the top three most polluting industries in the economy. So Xingyu, what have you found on whether vegetarianism really affect carbon footprints?
I've looked into an Oxford research actually says going vegan can reduce an individual's carbon footprint from food by 73%. So I think if we consume meat, then the volumes of food fed to the livestock, and also it goes to the process of being killed, processed, transported, and stored. And all of these processes can lead to greenhouse gases and making a negative impact on the environment. So that's why we're seeing more people, they are aware of this environmental protection and they're going vegan.
Mm. Coming up, join us in the happiest corner on the airwaves, Roundtable's Happy Place.
Delivery. Delivery. Delivery.
What is it?
Happiness from Round Table.
Josh, what is your happy place this week?
Well, recently, my dad, who has been a university lecturer for some time and also is a writer and dedicates his whole life to research and writing, basically, got his PhD. And actually, it's very late for him to get it. And he's sort of got quite far in his life having not actually achieved his PhD. And one of the reasons that it took him so long to get it was mainly, I think, because he had three kids when he was younger. And my oldest brother, he's got very severe learning disabilities. And at the time when my dad was considering to do this, his life took over and it just got quite complicated with other things and stuff like this. So it was always delayed and many other things happened, but he's finally achieved this at the ripe old age of 57 years old, which isn't that old, I guess. But for him, it's been a very, very long time coming. So I'm really proud of him. And I think that it's just probably the most influential thing that's happened in my own life when it comes to just showing that it doesn't really matter when you do it. We all live by these time schedules and it's always easy to think that, oh, it's too late to do this, especially when so many other people might do it at that age, you know, especially when it comes to academia or a career change or something like that. But he's done it really, really late and he's having success with it now. And obviously it's made me very, very happy. I'm very proud of him. And I think that it's just a real testament to lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. It's also his birthday tomorrow. So it's
happy birthday, Josh's dad.
I don't know if he'll be listening to this, but
we'll tell him. He has to listen now.
Thank you
for spreading the joy. And yes, we feel very happy for you, for your dad, and also just to learn that, yes, age may just be a number for some people. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Xingyu, what do you have for us?
And this also has something to do with what I'm going to share today. Age probably is only a number for Hayao Miyazaki, the iconic Japanese animator, anime director, and also manga artist who is now 83 years old. And recently, I just went to the theater to watch his latest production called The Boy and the Heron, which is an animated fantasy film produced by Studio Ghibli. I think the reason why I went to watch this movie is because it's believed to be the last one from this Japanese manga artist, although Miyazaki has announced his retirement 7 times before, but he hasn't fully stepped away from filmmaking. Actually, this movie gained huge popularity during the Qingming Festival holiday. It was the top grossing film with $54 million in revenue, accounting for almost half of the total earnings. The movie revolves around a boy named Mahito who lost his mother in a hospital fire during the World War II, and his father moves him from Tokyo to the countryside, where the father marries his late wife's sister. And then the boy encounters a peculiar gray heron, which leads him to an enchanting tower, and then they start this whole new adventure in a fantastic world. Some say this movie is a semi-autobiographical because some of the details overlap with Miyazaki's own childhood. Actually, I had quite high expectations before I went to the cinema, but when the movie ended, I was quite confused because I was completely lost. I didn't know what the movie was all about while after watching this, and I felt the ending was so abrupt. And after getting out of the cinema, I looked through some of the movie reviews and I found that I am not alone. Many of the many of the moviegoers have said this is the most difficult to understand movie from Miyazaki. And after seeing some of the movie reviews, I have a better understanding about this movie. I think it touches upon the themes of family, friendship, and also spiritual growth. It has a lot of symbolism and it's quite philosophical in a way. So I think that's my happy place. I want to share this movie with you guys and hopefully you can enjoy it too.
Yeah, lovely. And what you said reminds me of an interview I did with a film producer ages ago who works on animation. And he told me something along the lines that live action movies are often seeking an objective truth and animation is really seeking an emotional truth. And that's what I find in the life work of Hayao Miyazaki. And he is in his 80s now. Yeah. And this time, like you said, Xingyu, this is not the first time he says that. This is his last swan song, so to speak. And it brought to mind the late style theory. It's developed by literary critic and theorist Edward Sead. In his 2006 book on late style, he explored some artists authors, musicians, and other creators produced their most innovative and challenging works towards the end of their careers or lives. This late style can be markedly different from the creator's earlier works and is often characterized as out of step, unconventional, or at odds with the mainstream. And this could be true with Hayao Miyazaki's latest work. And also the reactions from moviegoers are kind of mixed and extreme. A friend of mine came out of the cinema crying her face off, and maybe rather than offering the beautiful and consoling fantastical worlds that define much of his celebrated film works, this film presents a fantasy realm that is not a beautiful refuge, but potentially even more bleak and unforgiving than reality. At the heart of the story lies the central question: how do you live? And I really appreciate the Chinese movie title, which goes along, how do you live, as opposed to the English international version, which is The Boy and the Heron. What does that even mean? But this question, how do you live? Miyazaki seems to be challenging his audience to confront life's most daunting existential quandaries head on, rather than seeking solace in idealized alternate realities, which we have seen in Totoro, in Spirited Away, in so many of his previous works. Yeah, it's still in the cinema, and feel free to check it out. And also, this ties everything up nicely as we share our thoughts about another animation movie in today's Happy Place. And that brings us to the end of today's roundtable. Thank you so much, Xing Yu and Josh Cotterell, for joining the discussion. I'm He Young. We'll see you next time.